Hey guys, and welcome back to Pocket Theology. I'm here with my buddy Martin. Martin, say hi to everyone.
Well, hello there, General Kenobi.
Nice. I like that. Anyways, it's the week of Christmas, both when we're recording this and when this comes out. We're just going to do a short little episode. So first of all, Merry Christmas to anyone listening to this, or Happy New Year, or if you're listening to it in the future, then whatever. Hopefully you'll make it to the next Christmas or New Year. That's our hope for you.
Yes, we do hope that no one listening to this dies.
Yeah, that's just in general. Actually part of our mission statement. We hope no one that listens to this dies. At least not soon. Anyway, today we wanted to do kind of a shorter, easier, funner sort of episode and just talk about our favorite Christmas passages. But we did not restrict ourselves just to the Gospels. I don't know which verse Martin finally landed on, but I know he was looking at least one in the Old Testament. So Martin, what verse did you finally land on? And tell us a little bit about that. Why is it your favorite Christmas verse or verses?
So first of all, Jason is referencing, I was deciding between Isaiah chapter 7 and John 1. Both of them are really awesome. I mean, images as a whole. But I think the Isaiah passage summarizes Christmas better. And I think that the John passage summarizes the theological implications a little bit better. And so I went with the Isaiah passage because Jason's going to pick something in the New Testament because he's Jason.
This is true. I am Jason.
Isaiah chapter 7, verses 13 and 14 says, "Then Isaiah said, 'Hear now, you house of David. Is it not enough to try the patience of humans? Will you try the patience of my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel.'" So, first of all, shout out Brandon Bradley. He's a buddy of ours who teaches, and basically anytime he gets ready to do anything, he starts off by saying Emmanuel, and then expects everybody else to say God with us.
Yeah. Yeah. Or he'll pass you in the hallway and just be like, "Hey, Emmanuel," and then God with us, which would be really confusing if we had any students named Emmanuel.
Yeah. But so Brandon's really a big part of why I love Emmanuel as the picture of Christmas. But that's part of why I picked this. I think that just the title of Emmanuel for God pictures Christmas really well. For those of you who haven't caught it yet, Emmanuel means God with us, but it's something really significant to our faith. And so as Isaiah is writing this, first of all, he's writing to exiles. The Israelites have been kicked out of Egypt and are for the most part in Babylon. They're serving as slaves. They've lost their faith. They've lost hope. And so the book of Isaiah holds a lot of messianic prophecies because he's teaching the Israelites to look forward to the Messiah coming. And this is one of those messianic prophecies. But he starts off and he's talking about, "Hear now, you house of David, it's not enough to try the patience of humans, but you're going to try the patience of God also." And they've been trying the patience of God for a while anyways.
They're real good at it.
They're so good at it. Our youth group is actually going through the Bible right now, just as a whole. And we got through the Old Testament, and I've kind of summarized the Old Testament as the Israelites suck at following God. That's kind of what it boils down to. There's a couple people that were really good, and some of the minor prophets call them the faithful remnant. But a lot of them just really suck, and as a whole, they don't follow well. So they end up getting exiled a couple of times. But this one specifically, I mean, if you look through the Old Testament, the prophets talk about it. Some of the writings will talk about it. And they'll say, you know, you've been exiled because of your unfaithfulness, because of your idolatry, because you no longer follow Yahweh. And so as these people are spending time in exile and they're trying to figure out what's going on, Isaiah writes this. And he says, "The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and we'll call him Emmanuel. We'll call him God with us." And part of why I think this is so important to these Israelites is when you look back at how God was with them priorly. They had the pillar of smoke and fire in Moses' time. They built the tabernacle, and God's presence was with them. And they built the temple, and God's presence was in the temple. And now they've been driven from their land. They don't have a place of worship. They don't have a place where God is dwelling currently. And Isaiah writes and tells them that there will be one who comes, and he will be God with you. And that's the promise of Jesus. And I love that idea of God with us, even through the Holy Spirit, when Jesus dies and is resurrected and goes to heaven. And he promises the Holy Spirit to the people. He promises that he will be with them. And so it's this amazing picture through the entirety of our scriptures on how God is with us, how God chooses to be with us. And that's one of the things that I think is really cool. When you look at a lot of other faiths, God is not with people. The gods are not with people. They're separate. They're better than them. They don't have to be. And for the most part, especially when you get into mythologies, God doesn't come to the people for their purposes. The gods will come and visit the people for the gods' purposes. And so they'll often have relationships with women so that they can bear children. They'll often...
The gods are, they're selfish.
They
in
are.
Most ancient cultures.
Exactly. And so when you look at Jesus coming to be with us, when you look at how Yahweh sends his son to be with us, it's not for his purposes. It's not because Yahweh's selfish. It's not because Yahweh is unloving. It's not because he wants to do it. It's because he wants us. It's for our benefit. It's not for his. And that's one of the things that I think is so important when we look at Emmanuel, when we look at Jesus as God with us.
Yeah, and part of that, like, the gods being separate, being better, is in Christianity and in Judaism, God doesn't need you, but for some unexplainable reason, he wants you. It's a good way of summarizing God's interactions with people. He doesn't need you, but for some reason, he wants you. In most ancient polytheistic cultures, the gods don't want you, but they kind of need you. Not that they'll like go extinct without you. They won't cease to exist, but they rely on people for power, like to grant them power, not to make them more strong as gods, but to grant them influence over human affairs, because it gives them nations that will serve them. They rely on people for food. They rely on people for shelter. They rely on people for clothing. And people use those sacrifices to manipulate the gods. So they have these very transactional relationships. The gods are facetious. They might just kill you because they feel like it. And Yahweh doesn't act that way. He acts compassionately. He has mercy on his people, even when they don't deserve it. And go read the Old Testament and just count up how many times people screw up. And God very rarely punishes them, especially to the extent that they deserve.
Exactly. And that's, you know, it's part of what makes our God different. So, Jason, I shared my passage. I shared why I liked it. Let's see what you came up with. You actually kind of told me, but let's tell everybody else what you came up with for your favorite Christmas passage of all time.
Yeah, so I went back and forth a little bit on what passage I wanted to do. I almost did the Benedictus, which is the fancy Latin name for the song that Zechariah, John's father, sings. They're at his circumcision and naming 8 days after his birth. And it's a beautiful song. It really celebrates the salvation that Jesus brings. And then at the end, when Zechariah finally talks to his kid, he talks about John's role in preparing the way for the Messiah. And that's something that we can still empathize with today. Now, John was an actual prophet. We are not. And John was literally preparing a society to receive the incarnate Christ. And we are not, because Jesus isn't physically walking among us today. But we are still preparing pathways for the Lord to enter into our communities and cultures. And that's significant. And it is somewhat similar to John's ministry in many ways, calling people to repentance, calling people to a knowledge of the Lord that they have either forgotten or outright rejected. So I almost did that. And I'd argue that maybe is my favorite Christmas passage. But I was really feeling drawn to Revelation 12 today. So I'm going to read a little bit of it and then I'll talk about it, explain it a little bit. So Revelation chapter 12, starting in verse 1. A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and with a crown of 12 stars. And she was pregnant, and she cried out, being in labor and in pain to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, and behold, there was a great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 crowns, and his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven and hurled them back to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth, so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. And then she gave birth to a son, a male, who is going to rule over all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared by God, so that she could be nourished there for 1,260 days. So we are introduced here to 3 characters, and I'll get into them in just a moment. 2 of them I think are pretty clear. 1 of them you might be a little bit confused about. The Book of Revelation, besides the first couple chapters, is what we call apocalyptic literature. That's a genre. Apocalypse does not mean the end of the world. In Greek, it doesn't mean the end of the world. In English, it does. But rather, it's a word that means revealing or revelation, which is why we call the book Revelation. Revelation, because apocalypse means revelation or revealing of something. So in a apocalypse literature, a revealing literature, there's a setup where a person is traveling through heaven or traveling through some sort of spiritual vision, and they have a guide. And the guide is often an angel, but sometimes is God, God himself. Really popular type of literature amongst Second Temple Jews. So Jews from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, on through Jesus's era and a little bit further. So Second Temple Jews really, really enjoyed this kind of literature. And the Apocalypse of John, Revelation, is set up in this way. So he has a vision and he's traveling through this vision of the heavens with alternatively an angel or God himself speaking to him, explaining certain things to him. And he's seeing these great mysteries and he's explaining these visions as he goes. So it's a heavily symbolic, these visions, just like Old Testament prophecies, they're heavily symbolic. They also contain a ton of references back to the Old Testament. We're not going to get into all the symbols and all the references back into the Old Testament today, but that's something to keep in mind. When you're reading Revelation, once you get past like chapter 3, there's going to be tons, even in chapters 1 through 3, there's tons of references to the Old Testament, tons of symbols, and time is not linear. So the world ends like 4 times in Revelation because it's not a story that starts at point A and ends at point B. Like it doesn't have a straight chronological organization. Rather, like years pass in just a few words, and then sometimes there's a single moment that gets like paragraphs and paragraphs, and the world will end and then they'll just keep going like the world never ended. Like time is not linear. It's more like loop-de-loops on a roller coaster. Like you're going back and then you're going forward, then you're having flashbacks, and it's really wild. That's the way that apocalypse literature is written. So we come to this scene, and you know, we have this wishy-washy timeline that doesn't make a ton of sense, but we're given one specific image that even in and of itself has some wishy-washy time. And we're first introduced to a character, the character of a woman. And a lot of people, when they read this is the character that might surprise you. They read this and they go, oh, that sounds Christmassy. That sounds like Mary, because it's a woman who's pregnant, who's going to give birth to this really significant child, who is obviously the Christ. When you read the description of the child, it's a male son who's going to rule over all the nations with the rod of iron and who has a special relationship with God and God protects him. That sounds like Jesus. And it is. I think that is meant to be Jesus. The woman, though, I don't think is Mary. Some people will say that it is. That's not, as far as I know, not the consensus amongst interpreters. Most people think that this woman is Israel, like the entirety of Israel. One big hint of this is that the woman is clothed with the sun and the moon, and these are symbols used in a dream that Joseph has in the Old Testament. So not Joseph, like the father of Jesus, but Joseph, the son of Israel, the person Israel in the Old Testament. he has this vision where 11 stars and the sun and the moon bow down to him, or this dream. He has another dream where sheaves of grain representing his brothers bow down. So in the second dream, the stars are his brothers, are meant to symbolize his 11 brothers. And the sun and the moon symbolize his mother and father. And he gets a lot of flack from his family about this, and then he's sold into slavery, and there's this huge story about how the people of Israel, his family, ends up in Egypt. It's all tied together. But this is one example of a place where the sun and the moon represent the people from whom the nation of Israel descended, Israel and his wife. That's one hint that we're talking about Israel here. She's clothed in the sun and the moon, and these are symbols of the entirety of Israel in Joseph's dream. We're also told that she has a crown with 12 stars on it. Those 12 stars in this passage are probably symbols of the 12 tribes of Israel. Whenever that number 12 shows up in Jewish writings, it often refers to, in some way, refers to the 12 tribes of Israel. And I think that's what it's doing here. So this woman shows up, she's probably symbolizing Israel, and she gives birth to a male child. And the idea here is that it's not just, like in Matthew and Luke, there's this huge emphasis on the importance of Mary as an individual, and she is important, and she is blessed by God, and Luke praises her a lot throughout Luke chapter 1 for her role that she plays in bringing the Messiah to bear on earth, but Revelation and Hebrews, for that matter, and many of Paul's writings emphasize that it's not just Mary. In fact, most of them don't even mention Mary, but rather it's the entire Jewish community, the line of faithful believers in Yahweh and his prophets dating back to time immemorial that have remained faithful, and they've prepared the way for the Messiah. And this is something that we forget, especially white people in the West forget, that communities make great people. So we tend to worship individuals who accomplish a lot in our sports. We don't think about great teams. We think about great individuals. We don't think about the 80s Bears. We think about the great players like Dick Butkus. We don't think about the early 2000s Patriots dynasty. We think about Tom Brady being an amazing quarterback. We don't think about the circumstances that led to business moguls like Elon Musk. Love him or hate him, he's had a lot of success in business. We don't think about the circumstances that created him. We just think about his individual genius. That's how we think in the West. And the reality is, no individual is great apart from the community that shaped them and the community that allowed them to have that success. And the same is true of Mary. Mary is a wonderful, faithful individual who believed in God's promises, but she is only possible because there is this thousands upon thousands of year old chain of believers that have followed Yahweh faithfully, that have passed on their faith generation after generation, and they have created this woman, this descendant of theirs, who is faithful to the Lord and believes his promises, and then she will play a very special role in bringing the Messiah into the world. And Revelation chapter 12 reminds us the entire community of Israel for generation after generation was necessary for Jesus to come and live and teach and die on our behalf. So even if you are not that great individual, you are a part of a community that will produce those great individuals. And your role is still vitally important. You may never get the recognition, but your role is still vitally important. That's a great lesson to remember at Christmas. The entire community of believers, back to Abraham, even beyond Abraham, that entire community was necessary to bring God in the flesh, to bring Jesus to the earth, to live and teach and die among us. Now, we talked a little bit about the woman. We talked a little bit about the child. The dragon is a really fun character, too. And then the passage that I read, the little chunk that I read, he's not identified. If you keep reading just a few more verses, this dragon is explicitly called the devil and Satan. So this dragon is identified in chapter 12 as the devil and Satan. And he's pictured here wanting to devour the child. Now, this is not to be interpreted hyper-literally. The devil was not crouching in the corner of the room that Jesus was born in with his little pitchfork, like hoping no one sees him so he can jump out and eat a baby. That's not what's going on. But symbolically, the idea is this dragon, the Satan, the adversary, is what that title means. is opposing the birth of the Messiah. He doesn't want this to happen. So the way that that's represented in Revelation chapter 12 is it says that he wants to devour the child as soon as he's born. And we see all the people groups that are manipulated, not just when Jesus is born, but even later, into opposing the mission of the Messiah. So we see King Herod try to kill all the young boys that were born in the area to oppose the birth of the Messiah, to keep him from growing up and becoming a king and deposing Herod and whatever. We see the Pharisees and the Sadducees try to kill him long before his appointed time because they don't like the things that he's teaching. Satan is manipulating people into opposing the gospel message, into opposing the Messiah from the very beginning, and he never gives up. And this is important because the same kind of lesson should bear out today. We don't like talking about Satan in some of our churches, and some of our churches like talking about him way too much and giving him way too much credit. But we should have a healthy understanding of who the devil is and what the devil does. And the reality is the devil is still opposing the church today. He's real, and he's manipulating people, even people who are totally unaware of him, into opposing the gospel and into opposing Jesus and trying to prevent the spread of the message of God throughout the world. And we see this in verse 17, the last verse of the chapter, where John writes, "So the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus." So the last verse in this chapter says the dragon, and the chunk that I skipped, the dragon is kicked out of heaven, which is one of those like wishy-washy timeline things, because that definitely happened way earlier. So we see this picture of Jesus's birth, but Jesus being birthed by the entire community of Israel, which dates back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And then just a few verses later, we see this image of Michael the archangel kicking Satan out of heaven. But that happened, again, thousands and thousands, actually maybe millions of years earlier, just depending on where exactly you place Genesis and how you interpret the first 11 chapters of Genesis and all of that. The point being, the timeline is really weird in Revelation, but the message is still clear. The dragon is kicked out of heaven. He's prevented from destroying the Christ. He's prevented from harming the woman Israel, at least to the extent that he wants to. And so he only has one target left, which is the children of the woman. I think that's an identifier for the church. So he goes off to wage war against, quote, those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. That is a description of Christians. So Revelation chapter 12 reminds us, first of all, that the entire community of believers is necessary to bear out God's will in the world. Even if you never get the recognition, even if you never have the platform, even if you never have the stage, even if you're never a great preacher, or even if you never preach from a stage at all, even if you're never a leader in the church, it doesn't matter. You're a part of the community that is accomplishing God's will in the world, and that is a wonderful thing. Second of all, it reminds us that the devil is real and the devil is active, and he is attacking the church even today. And we need to be prepared for that spiritual warfare. So I think Revelation chapter 12 is an amazing chapter that is a wonderful Christmas passage, reminding us of the importance of each of our roles and our need to be prepared for the coming wars or the coming battles that we'll see throughout our lifetime against the forces of Satan and those who knowingly or unknowingly serve him. So I love that passage. It's intense, and you should hide a little plastic dragon in your mangers to remind you, because that's pretty
good. Dragons are just cool.
Dragons are awesome. Not this dragon. This dragon's a jerk.
Yeah, but dragons in general, kind of cool. So... yeah, we just want to take a second. We want to thank you guys for listening with us. It's been, I don't even know how long since we started this, so we're thankful for all the people that have stuck with us and continue to listen to us. We want to say Merry Christmas, and we want to wish you a Happy New Year. Make sure that, you know, you're enjoying your holidays, spend some time with your family, with friends, and besides that, we'll see you guys in about a week.
Peace.